It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Chances are slim that you've ever become acquainted with a phenomenological psychologist. It's also not all that likely that you've met an internationally acclaimed blues guitarist. 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker knows a Pittsburgh native who checks both of those boxes. His name is Ernie Hawkins, and Bob spent some time with him recently, asking about what motivated his pursuit of two seemingly incongruous fields of study and how learning one subject might dovetail with learning the other.
Ernie, that sounds like something from so long ago. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing right now?
I'm just messing around in the key of E in a kind of a loosely conceived Mississippi style from kind of a Skip James kind of thing.
That's a name I don't know. I think you're probably going to mention a lot of names I don't know during the course of the conversation. What you do is something you do because you have to do. It started really young. And I'd like to go ahead and just have you tell me about when you knew that music was something you had to pursue with a passion.
Well, when I realized how screwed up I was in, like, early on in high school and how maybe alienated I was, I don't know. I had a friend who played a little banjo. I learned a little bit of that. But it was when I picked up a guitar, I saw the whole world. I just thought you could just say anything you wanted through this instrument. At the same time, you know, this was like the early 60s when the kind of the folk scare was happening and country blues records were starting to come through. It just knocked me over. I remember hearing Statesboro Blues. It was recorded in 1927 by Blind Willie McTell. It changed my life. It was so beautiful, and I fell in love with McTell. And, of course, then I started getting some of the reissue records that were coming out and hearing Robert Johnson and Mississippi Blues and Texas Blues and Chicago Blues. And it wasn't until I finally heard a Reverend Gary Davis record called Harlem Street Singer that I was just completely hooked. Just completely hooked.
Well, Delilah, she was a woman. She was fine and fair. She had good loose, God knows, and cool black hair.
Delilah, you mentioned several styles of blues, but country blues is where you started. And some people call that Eastern blues and Piedmont style. Can you give me just a quick, concise definition of how it developed differently than blues in other parts of the country?
I sort of divide blues into like two major categories, Piedmont or East Coast blues, and Texas, Mississippi type blues. And in a general sense, although there are lots of exceptions, it's just two different styles of playing. And say in Mississippi and particularly Texas blues, you generally have one bass going. Let me show you what I mean. So you got a steady bass doing this. That kind of a pulse, and difference between that and East Coast Piedmont blues, particularly in the hands of somebody like Gary Davis, is that they're going to be moving the basses a lot more, so and playing counterpoint. To my ears, East Coast blues, a lot jazzier. So it was a more kind of musically a little bit more sophisticated in some ways. To me, the Texas-Mississippi stuff is a lot more country sounding, very emotional, deeply personal, in a way more straightforward.
I think at this point I'd like to find out how you became a PhD in phenomenological psychology after you had already been immersed in music. And the question is, how are they rooted in this one individual, this one native Pittsburgher?
That's a really good question. I've never been able to figure it out. I always knew I wanted an education. I barely made it out of high school. I was already playing a lot. I wanted to meet Gary Davis. I moved to New York City. I learned a lot of stuff from Gary Davis.
And you went to New York City as soon as you graduated high school. You took off like the next day, right?
Exactly, the next day. And spent a lot of time there. Came back to Pittsburgh, brought him to Pittsburgh a lot, concerts and just for him to hang out. But I always knew I wanted an education. I just kind of enrolled at Pitt back in those days. After kind of a rocky start, I started loving being in school, completely different than high school. You were free. You could do whatever you wanted. Kind of got bit by the philosophy bug, took some great philosophy classes, spent a lot of time over at Duquesne studying phenomenology. I kind of discovered that. It's a long story. If there's any similar thing, maybe it was just passion, kind of a similar kind of passion.
And briefly, the study of philosophy is pretty much just the study of human existence and the nature of the reality within which we live. And phenomenology is just a form of philosophy and an extension of what you started with?
Well, yeah, that's what it's kind of supposed to be. That was well put. But a lot of American and British philosophy stopped becoming a study of human existence and started becoming a study of language and logic and that kind of thing. And phenomenology was kind of returned to the roots of what philosophy really was and directly questioning experience and stuff like that. And it was kind of a breath of fresh air. Existentialism came out of phenomenology. It was more of a reaction to the scientistic points of view that came up through the Enlightenment. I just got into it pretty deeply. I got lucky. I got a scholarship to the University of Dallas where they had a new phenomenological psychology program. So I went out there for 5 years. While there, I met a wonderful guitar player named Art Eskridge, died recently. He was a third-generation Santa Fe railroad worker, beautiful singer. Learned how to play blues from a guy in Oklahoma City named Poor Bill Miller, beautiful guitar player, showed me how Texas music worked, and really taught me a lot of Texas blues. So there I was in Texas, really learning something wonderful at the same time I was in school. Very lucky.
Has that been a constant throughout your career, learning about things that would come under the heading of philosophy as you learned music and finding yourself opening up to new thoughts in both disciplines simultaneously?
That's a pretty good way of putting it. I was always just interested in everything. And it's philosophy in an everyday, direct way. It's people and the way people thought and the way things worked. And of course, blues is the greatest, deepest, most versatile philosophy ever. I mean, any kind of emotion, any kind of feeling, any kind of image, everything is there in blues, you know, with this deep, deep, deep music and deep experience. And there's just nothing like American country blues.
So to get a little bit chronological here, you took off after graduating high school in 65. And went to New York City and studied with Gary Davis.
Yeah.
And then over the next few years, you brought him back to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And started academic pursuits.
Yeah, I never expected to be a musician, professional musician. I didn't know really what I was going to be. But I thought I wanted an education, and I thought maybe philosophy wasn't a good idea. It was too obscure. Of course, I did something really obscure and got a great education, very lucky.
And at that point, you began in earnest at some point after that, you began in earnest, no pun intended, a career as a professional musician, which took you a lot of places, but it also rooted you in Pittsburgh for a number of years. Can you give me a quick thumbnail sketch of what you did when you did it musically over, say from the mid-70s through the mid-90s? Give me about a 20-year window.
Well, after graduate school, I decided to take a little time off. It's a long story. I wandered around. I was playing a lot of acoustic music, and there were a lot of great players around that I met. Traveled all over the country, played a lot of radio shows and stuff and TV. and got into a little bit of electric guitar, playing in blues bands for a while. Played with Gary Beloma for 10 years, for instance. Wonderful band, wonderful experience. Loved it very much. We played every joint, every picnic, every fist fight in Pittsburgh for a period of about 10 years. It was great. But then I kind of started missing my acoustic stuff, and I started making some solo acoustic recordings. I started doing a lot of teaching DVDs, how to play at Lightning Hopkins, Mance Lipscomb, Gary Davis, Blind Willie McTell, Big Bill Brunzi, stuff like that. And that kind of put me on the map, because they had big catalogs that went to guitar players all over the world, really. And anywhere you went, there were guitar players that knew who you were from these things and were buying your records and stuff, and you could go and give concerts and give workshops and stuff, and my wife and I would travel all over the world and all over the country doing that kind of thing. We were just having a wonderful time playing all over the place, and it was terrific.
Thanks for hanging around and letting me ask you a whole bunch of questions.
Thank you, Bob. My pleasure.
That's Ernie Hawkins speaking with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker. Hawkins will be performing this Saturday evening at 7:30 along with harmonica virtuoso Clint Hoover at the First Unitarian Church in Oakland. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, many of the country's most prolific piano players got their start in Pittsburgh. Coming up as part of our Good Question series, a look at the city's deep bench of musical talent. Plus, what do ongoing book bans tell us about modern censorship? Why are they still happening? And why are children's and young adult literature so often the targets? Later this hour, a preview of this year's Banned Books Week with members of Carnegie Mellon's English Department. Those stories, conversations, and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Allegheny Arsenal in Pittsburgh's Lawrenceville neighborhood explodes in 1862. Many believe the explosion was caused by a metal horseshoe that sparked a fire with some loose powder. 78 workers were killed, and most of them were young women. The explosion was reportedly heard 2 miles away. It happened during the Civil War, and the site was an important manufacturing center for the Union Army. Now there's a park and a school named after the arsenal and memorial to the explosion victims. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than 5,000 people are serving life sentences in Pennsylvania prisons without the possibility of release. Ralph Bolden is one of them. He was convicted of first-degree murder after killing a man during a robbery in 1994. In prison, Bolden is taken to writing. He and five other men, most of whom are also sentenced to life, have chronicled their experiences in a new book called Life Sentences. Bolden called 90.5 WESA's Ann Lee Herring from inside a state prison in Erie County.
What do you hope people get out of the book?
When we incarcerate someone, we send them away from us. That trash, throwing it away. So I hope our book lets people know that although we have made some bad choices in our lives, that we are still human beings. And most of us here in these prisons do want to change. We want to get better.
In the book, you say your crime was a reaction to a system that you felt was seeking to grind you into the ground, but you say that's not an excuse. So it sounds like you see yourself as both a victim and a victimizer. Where do you draw that line?
It comes to the point where whenever you go through trauma, one of the things that happens to the victim is sometimes they become a victimizer themselves. Their reaction may be something that is, it's them trying to figure out what to do with the world, how to define the world, and their perception of the world may change. Mine did. once I felt all these inequities and all these things happening to me, along with the stress I was dealing with and the anxiety I was dealing with, it caused me to be in a different mind state than what I was. And again, this is not an excuse. This is explaining what's happening to me. And I was getting good feedback from my family and concern from them about what I should be doing. But at the time, I dissociated myself from that. So that's why I draw the line at, because I still had choices. I tried to get help, but it didn't work. I should have tried again.
What prompted you to take responsibility and to stop making excuses?
Actually, it started with me, honestly, in the courtroom. When I heard the wife of the man that I shot, when I heard her speak about her husband, something in that, the way she looked at me and spoke to me. She said, I'm not sure if you understand me or if you understand what I'm saying to you, but you just didn't kill one person. You killed more than one person. You know, this man was my friend, my best friend, my children's father, someone's son. And as she went through this, it just really was, I didn't mean, first of all, as a young man, I'm like, I didn't mean to hurt her. I didn't mean to hurt his children or anybody else. And it just dawned on me, like, wow, what did I do? You know, and I looked behind me and I saw the tears in the, excuse me, I saw the tears in the faces of my family also, you know, and I'm like, what did I do? You know, all the bravado and the braggadocios in the street, all that stuff just left. And that began something within me that I saw that I had to get better, that I was really sorry for what I'd done.
You initially spent 5 years on death row, mm-hmm. then you appealed your sentence and got life in prison. How did that change the way you thought about your situation or yourself and your future?
It gave me more of an opportunity to be something other than just sitting in a cell. Because, you know, as you know, death row was solitary confinement, so you're sitting in a cell all day. So now off of death row, I was coming out, and I got to see other people who were just trying to figure out what to do. I became a tutor when I started doing other things. So it gave me a better understanding to find out who I was as a person, why I'm here on this planet. I wasn't put on this planet to be a thug or a tough guy or whatever. And at one time, I thought that's what being a man was. And that time, I got to realize who I was supposed to be on death row. So coming off of death row, I got to put that in action.
That was WESA Government and Accountability reporter Anlie Herring speaking with Ralph Bolden. Bolden wrote the book Life Sentences with five other men who are or were incarcerated in Pennsylvania. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Are you a currently enrolled college student looking for an internship? Are you interested in working on Pittsburgh's only local public radio daily news program? 90.5 WESA's The Confluence is looking for interns this semester. Send us an email with your resume, cover letter, and writing samples to hr@pittsburghcommunitybroadcasting.org.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many of the country's most prolific pianists got their start in Pittsburgh. As part of our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley looks at how the city cultivated such a deep bench of musical talent.
Good Question's Wesley Gill asked,
I have always wondered if Pittsburgh ever had a piano factory, and if so, where they were located and what the name of the factory or factories was.
In 1814, a man named Charles Rosenbaum took out an ad in the newspaper. Heinz History Center historian Ann Matarath says Rosenbaum was selling pianos he had made for $250 to $350.
That shop burns down in January of 1816, and he never appears in the newspapers or the city directories again.
At the time, Pittsburgh was experiencing substantial growth. The iron, glass, and coal industries helped position the city as a commercial center. Matarath says for there to be a piano manufacturer, there had to be interest in the market and customers who could pay.
The piano becomes kind of a symbol of a refinement or civilization or culture, and the ability to have one in your home signifies the same. So it's a great object to talk about not just music history, the making of pianos, but also the city at that point in time.
Rosenbaum's departure didn't spell the end of piano sales in Pittsburgh. And while most pianos were imported, the talent wasn't. The city has produced some incredible players over the years.
Ahmad Jamal,
Stephen Foster,
Franklin Amundo, Johnny Costa,
Mary Lou Williams,
Ethelbert Nevin,
Errol Garner, Billy Strayhorn.
These are classically trained musicians, jazz band leaders, and composers who played in and around Pittsburgh. Joe Rivita with Fort Pitt Piano in McCandless says there was plenty of opportunity to play in neighborhoods like the Hill District and downtown.
You could go out Monday through Sunday night and find either jazz or dance music or big band.
Jazz musicians traveling between New York and Chicago would stop at Pittsburgh clubs like the Crawford Grill and the Savoy Ballroom. And aspiring young players could watch greats like Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk, and Nina Simone.
Music is around Pittsburgh on a regular basis, and I think the sheer amount of culture here brings it up.
Area piano teacher Andrea Doyle says people are drawn to the piano because it's such a flexible, versatile instrument.
The piano, you can do everything yourself. You can play any style of music you like. You can enjoy all of those, just one person.
While many young players attribute their musical passions to seeing jazz and classical pianists perform around Pittsburgh, the city had no shortage of formal training schools. For nearly 50 years, the Pittsburgh Music Institute in Oakland offered programs to students like Ahmad Jamal and Billy Strayhorn. Teachers like Mary Cardwell Dawson trained a generation of black musicians, and Westinghouse High School cultivated the talent of its students, including Errol Garner. On a recent summer day, a crowd packed into a lot on Wiley Avenue in the Hill District. It's Pittsburgh Piano Day, an annual event started by piano technician Peter Stumpf, where a Steinway piano is carted around the city on a flatbed. Anyone can climb on the truck and play, including an elderly mother.
Who's 95 years old, she'd love to come and play. And see, I love that. Music is a lifelong friend. It is faithful to the end, and this woman is 95 years old, she wants to come and play.
This event took place next to Crawford Grill, the jazz club shuttered decades ago. Now there are new efforts to revitalize this space and bring live music back to the Hill. Stump says he's glad to have Piano Day help bring attention to it.
One of the most beautiful comments I'm hearing is, only in Pittsburgh. This is such a Pittsburgh thing. You know, I'm loving that because we always do things a little bit different here and try to make it a little bit better and certainly make it our own.
I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Submit your own question at WESA.FM. It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Book banning conjures up images of decades ago, repressive regimes trying to squash the free exchange of ideas. But many books are still banned in the U.S. today. Who's making those decisions? Who are they hoping to protect? We're going to talk about censorship in literature with Kitty Shropshire, PhD student in English, Literary, and Cultural Studies at Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome, Kitty.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Christy Bastardi is a member of Pennsylvania Book Fairies. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Brenda Green is board chair of the Pittsburgh chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to the Confluence, Brenda.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm going to start with something simple. What does it mean to ban a book? Brenda, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, actually, there are two terms. There's a challenge or a ban. And challenging is much more common. That just takes one individual at a school board meeting or the state legislature or a letter to the editor to suggest a book should not be available to a certain population for whatever reasons. And then when it's banned, it's actually banned, where there's some type of legal action taken or something punitive. And as you've mentioned, in some countries, including this, at one time it included book burning.
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to you as book lovers and educators, Kitty?
When books are banned, we take choice away from students. Students love to read, and they like the opportunities that books give them to look at the world beyond their own experience. And so when books are challenged or banned and taken away from them, they're losing that opportunity, and it's just a shame as an educator and as a reader.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
Yeah, I agree. You know, we read books for personal reasons, to explore the outside world, and to learn. And I think banning books or challenging books prohibits someone from expanding their own knowledge about certain topics and prohibits us from being an informed society, really.
How did our country's own issues with book banning develop?
Rhonda?
Well, actually, for the first 100 years, the First Amendment wasn't actively enforced in this country. And it's not just the censorship issue. It was the free exercise clause of religion in the First Amendment, as well as establishment of that. So censorship in – at one time, there was a law in the books in New York that you couldn't show safe cracking or hobos jumping on trains or drug use in films or they'd be pulled. So we have a long history of censorship. It really wasn't until – actually, I'll take credit for this – until the ACLU was formed a century ago and started challenging it. And it was slow going. The first cases, we lost repeatedly. So it has been an evolution, as most things are.
Well, so First Amendment, freedom of speech, wasn't enforced at all that much? What?
No, I would give us a D minus on the First Amendment for the first century. Okay. I mean, at one time, there were religious oaths required for public office, mm-hmm. and, you know, loyalty clauses, and, you know, it was really difficult. It wasn't until after World War I, when what I call the Clear and Present Danger trilogy, where people were opposing the draft. And actually, the ACLU lost all three of those cases. And then eventually, in the early 60s, we saw a turnaround in that. But censorship of all the violations of the First Amendment has been the most difficult to eradicate.
What are, to each of you, what do you think are the broader implications of banning a book beyond the prohibition of a single work of writing? Go ahead, Kitty.
I think the implications are that people don't have the right to choose what they want to read, how they want to educate themselves, and it really has a chilling effect on expression and artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, it's an issue of private versus state. That when you have a government telling people what they can have access to, rather it's what's covered in a newspaper or what's shown on TV or what books are allowed on a public library shelf, it has a very chilling effect on dissent.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
I agree. And again, it goes back to making your own personal choices. And if you choose to read something and you feel it's beneficial to you in some way, for another outside party or organization to tell you you can't read it is suppression, really.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin, joined in studio with educators and book lovers talking about why and how book banning got started. What famous writers or their books might we be surprised to learn had some of their writings banned? Brenda?
Well, one of the things that always amazed me, because I grew up in the Cambria County Library, like that was my home away from home. Mm-hmm. And children's books are the most common banned. And also worldwide, the Bible mm-hmm. is the most banned book in literature.
All right. And Kitty?
So people are always surprised when they see the list of books that have been banned and challenged, because it includes books that they have read in school. So everything from modern classics to Shakespeare have been challenged at some point. So to ask what books have banned, you're essentially asking what books are there.
Mm-hmm. Christy? What stands out to you that might even surprise you?
Some extremely popular novels like Harry Potter. Harry Potter's often challenged or banned for a variety of reasons.
Why?
Some have said that it's anti-family. From some are challenging it from a religious perspective.
Witchcraft?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, and even like Kitty said, books that we've read in school, To Kill a Mockingbird, mm-hmm. There's just a lot of books that we might view as formulating in our childhood and in our youth have been challenged and taken away from other students mm-hmm. in different areas.
Christy, I see you have a copy of a book that is challenged and banned in some places. What do you have there?
I have in front of me Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. I'm sure many are very familiar with this book. And it's actually decorated in a sense. Right now, it has a Book Fairy sticker on it and an ACLU sticker on it. And it's going to be hidden somewhere in the city sometime today for someone to find and read.
In addition, other famous authors. I mean, a Nobel Prize winner, Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. Bestseller, Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, of course, Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird. People might say, really? And the answer is, Yes.
Well, if you go down the list of Nobel Prize winners and Pulitzer Prize winners, a large number of them have been banned or challenged for a number of reasons.
People might remember a very chilling book that later became a movie, Fahrenheit 451, a futuristic look at book banning and burning. Ironically, that book was banned because I think it had references to burning
books,
the Bible.
And also obscenity. So there's been, when it was originally published, there was another edition that the publishers put out that changed all of, or omitted all of the curse words. So obscenity is another reason that books are often challenged or banned, particularly for young readers.
Or sexuality.
Yeah.
References
that's a big
to
one.
Christy, you mentioned J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter books. Best-selling author Judy Blume has also been banned. Why is that? Why has that happened?
Well, I think with Judy Blume, a lot of it deals with the fact that it's female sexuality, particularly the onset of puberty, and just the questioning of that and the exploration of Bibles, of our bodies. Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank has been banned for the same reason, because of her very and in fact, the first publication of that book, they took out some of the sections where she talks about her body changing.
Are children's books, are youth, young adult literature, are they more typically targeted for possible banning? And why so?
Yes, they tend to be, because people are concerned about what is age appropriate for children. And children always don't have the same ideas about what's appropriate for them as the adults in their lives. So a lot of young adult books deal with more mature themes because children are reaching an age where they are exploring their sexuality, where they're going to be tempted by alcohol and drug use by their peers. And so they use these books as a way to work through those issues. But parents are often concerned that the mere exposure to those ideas are going to encourage those kids. So young adult literature particularly becomes a real hot issue when it comes to censorship.
So should that be more of a parental responsibility than censorship? I don't want my child reading that.
Yeah, I think parents should encourage their children to read, and they should introduce them to books. And many parents use these books, Judy Blume mainly, to talk about some of these issues. But parents don't have the right to remove that from other people's children. So that's why we encourage parents to talk to their children about books and to find books and read with their children. But that doesn't give them the right to pull them from library shelves, because other parents want their children to have those books.
Our guests on The Confluence are Kitty Shropshire, who teaches classes at CMU on book banning, Christy Bastardi, a member of the Pennsylvania Book Fairies, and Brenda Green, chair of the board of the Pittsburgh chapter of the ACLU. Kitty, you teach a class on book banning. What's the initial reaction from your students to the concept of book banning?
They're always surprised, unless they happen to have been in a school where a challenge has taken place. They're surprised to see that we're still banning books and challenging books in this day, because we have this idea that the First Amendment protects people very robustly. And so they're just unaware of this. But then when we read the books and we start to put them in context, why were they banned? Why were they challenged? It allows them to see how these books connect to broader social issues. And I think it's actually a really robust way to teach novels.
So how do you teach that idea of book banning?
So we read stories, a lot of newspaper articles about a particular book that has been banned and why, and then we look at the text and we do close reading of the passages that might be controversial and have caused the challenge, and we kind of ask, well, in what context is this upsetting to people? How could students be taught this material in a way that is well-structured and rigorous? And so it's not just this idea that you read it and you absorb it and then you act out the things that you see. So taking that time to really look at it closely allows students to see where these challenges are coming from and how they can respond to them if they are challenged.
Are they concerned? Are they worried about how censorship might affect them?
They are. They are concerned that they might end up in situations, particularly as they get older, where their own expression will be curtailed by other people. Because it's not just what book banning does to readers, but also to creators. And so when you have students who want to go into writing, they begin to think, oh, do I need to self-censor? Who are these audiences? And it has a chilling effect on them as well.
What about in schools where maybe the teacher requires, the curriculum requires students to read a book that maybe some parents might find objectionable? What are your thoughts on that, Brenda?
Well, I get very nervous whenever academic freedom is infringed on and teachers feel the need to self-censor their curriculum based on that. And in good school districts, there should be curriculum review panels and there should be an option for parents to look at that and raise their voices and concerns, but then it should be dealt with in a productive manner with a due process procedure so that things are not randomly pulled, because the last thing we want is dedicated, hardworking educators to self-censor or choose to leave the field.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
I agree. To have those educators self-censor or be censored by parents who do not have the training that they have, who do not have the background to teach these students, the teachers make those decisions based on what they think is going to be best in their classroom and what they think their students are going to benefit the most from.
You mentioned Toni Morrison.
Right.
Yesterday, I was picking up books at the reserve desk in the Squirrel Hill branch of the Carnegie Library, and they have a poster of her in there and with the quote, "If the book that you want to read doesn't exist, maybe you should write it." Mm-hmm. And when you talk to authors or hear authors talk, so often they talk about reading being a key component in the development of their skills and their creativity. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's so important not to pull books from shelves.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side, might it be useful for some educators or parents to expose the children to the concepts through literature, things like activism or tough topics concerning race, recent bestseller, for instance, Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give. Thoughts?
I recently read Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, and it opened my eyes to some social issues that I'm not exposed to on a day-to-day basis. And I came out of reading that book believing that everyone should read it because it is so educational and so insightful that I would feel I felt more knowledgeable when I came out of reading it. And it was entertaining at the same time. And it's a good way to teach. It's a good way to teach your children, students, friends about issues that are sometimes difficult to talk about or to converse about.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple minutes left. Christy, one way to circumvent the banning of books is to give them away. Book Fairies
exactly.
Does just that. So what are you giving away? What are you doing in regard to that?
The Book Fairies, we along with the ACLU and Carnegie Mellon University, are working this week to hide banned books all over the city for others to find and read. And so if you're out and about, keep an eye out because you might find something that you could take home with you.
I assume they're not going to be too difficult to find.
They won't be. They'll be right in plain sight.
And briefly, what else is going on Banned Books Week?
Yeah, actually, Banned Books, a combination of the library, Carnegie Mellon University, and the ACLU is celebrating the freedom to read. And it'll be taking place next Tuesday at the lecture hall at the Carnegie Library in Oakland. And it starts at 7 or 6?
Well, we'll have a listing
on our
website, WESA.fm.
And really encourage people to come out for that.
Okay. Just a couple sentences. Would you be pleased if Banned Books Week went away, if no longer books were banned? Go ahead. Start with you, Kitty.
I would be pleased if books were no longer banned. But there is a flip side where banning books actually excites children to read. If you tell them they can't, it has this inverse effect where they're like, actually, I'm going to read that book.
Brenda.
Actually, we're celebrating the centennial of the ACLU's case to overturn the ban on Ulysses this year.
James Joyce.
And yes. And so I would definitely not want it to go away because, again, history repeats itself because we don't learn the first time. It's important for us to remember our past.
And this helps us recall the past.
And we need to celebrate that we have come so far on this issue.
All right, Christy.
Yeah, Banned Books Week in itself is educational. Mm-hmm. It teaches others about banned books, challenged books, things they might not have known about, and it encourages people to be active in pursuing their own intellectual freedom.
Christy Bastardi is a member of Pennsylvania Book Fairies, which will be distributing and hiding books throughout the Pittsburgh area. Kitty Shropshire is a PhD student at CMU, and she teaches a class on book banning. And Brenda Green is chair of the Pittsburgh chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, during this decade, we have lost 10,000 acres of tree canopy in Allegheny County alone. It's more than aesthetics. It can impact air and noise pollution, increase the possibility of landslides. Tree Pittsburgh is trying to restore the canopy one tree at a time. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past episodes, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was produced by Kylie Kaczynski, engineered by Helen Wigger, production assistance from Julia Zenkovich and Avery Keatley. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.